Good morning. It is good to be here. I always feel like I'm among friends, and so good to see all of your faces this morning, as always. This is one change since last year. I have to wear glasses now to see my notes, so I guess I'm getting older. I also am here on the condition that I not do any impersonations this year. Wendell was very clear about that. So there will be no... No, I'm kidding. But I if you were here last year, I spent the first like 10 minutes of my time impersonating Joel Osteen, and I was just going to do a couple little lines, but as I looked at Wendell, he looked increasingly uncomfortable, and so I decided to just prolong his pain. But I'm not going to do that this morning. We do love to be here with you all, and I know some of you are I haven't even met yet, but many old friends, and we always enjoy being with you. So this week, I was trying to catch a quick nap at home on the living room floor, which made me the perfect prop for my five-year-old Tabitha's little game of make-believe. She was playing doctor and using her pink stethoscope to examine the unconscious patient. And so she checked my heart, and then she checked my forehead, and then she commented to her imaginary assistant in very sober tones, "His eyes are closed. This means he's had a heart attack." Did you know that big people play make-believe too? They assume importance and authority and position and glory that they do not really possess. Maybe you're familiar with the story of Frank Abagnale. He was one of the most famous imposters of all times in the 1960s and 70s, I believe it was, as a young man. Even as a teenager, he managed to convince all kinds of people that he had credentials he really didn't have. For example, for 11 months, he reportedly served as a supervising physician at a Georgia hospital, having no medical training whatsoever. He quit when he began to worry that he was actually putting people's lives at risk, which I think was a good idea. He pretended to be a Harvard-educated lawyer for a while and was somehow hired with the Louisiana Attorney General's office. And this is my favorite. He got a hold of a pilot's uniform and with a fake ID was hired with Pan Am Airlines. According to Pan Am, between the time that Abagnale was 16 and 18 years old, he logged over 1 million miles, traveling to over 26 foreign countries, eating at restaurants and staying at hotels on the airline's dime. And some people think there's some exaggeration there. I don't know. A movie was made about him called Catch Me If You Can, and I think he actually spoke at Josh's company a few years ago. He works for the FBI now, and he's kind of a fraud expert. He was caught, by the way, and he was put in prison. I think he got out because he agreed to help them catch people like himself. Now, here's the thing. You and I do this, too. Would you believe that we sometimes pretend to be who we are not? And we pretend to have what we do not have. You think it's outrageous that a teenager would impersonate a doctor or an airline pilot. But what if I told you that we're guilty of something that's far more outrageous, something even more far-fetched? Do we sometimes try to take the place of God himself? Never really saying it like that, but laying claim to things that aren't ours, that are his alone. And that's when playing make-believe becomes dangerous. I want to learn with you this morning from someone who had no interest in playing make-believe, somebody who knew his true place and was content to embrace his humble position. And it might not be who you're thinking of. And so if you have your Bibles with you, if you could turn to 1 Samuel chapter 18. And I want to start with some background. So be patient if this is a review for you, which I assume to be the case for many. When God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, as you'll recall, it was his desire and his intention, indeed his promise, to be their one and only king, to lead them, to provide for them, and to protect them perfectly as no other king could do. But sadly, Israel rejected the living God as their king. And not only that, they even rejected their own identity because they had been called to be a light to all the nations. Remember, they were to be a holy people set apart unto God, different from all the other nations on the earth. But they demanded of Samuel, give us a king to rule over us so that we can be like the other nations. So they rejected their king and they rejected their own identity. And Samuel warned them that this was evil, that in fact it would bring disaster on them, yet they persisted in their demand. And God gave them what they wanted, reminding a despairing Samuel, it's not you that they're rejecting me. So Saul was appointed as the first king over Israel. He started out, I think, very humbly, but soon all of that pride got to him, and the power went to his head, and he decided that he would serve God on his own terms. So he kind of served God, and he sort of served God, and he partially obeyed. And the other word for partial obedience, of course, is disobedience, right? And so God commanded Saul, for example, to attack the Amalekites, just destroy them completely, wipe them out, even their livestock. It was not a suggestion. And Saul kind of obeyed and sort of partially obeyed. He killed everyone but the king. He destroyed all the livestock except the very best. And when Samuel arrived at Gilgal, you remember the scene. Saul came to him and he dressed all this up in spiritual language with all kinds of excuses for his disobedience. And he said to Samuel, oh, the Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's commands today. I'm going to sacrifice all these animals to the Lord. And Samuel wasn't buying any of it. And he said, to obey is better than sacrifice. And this is significant. This is the part I want to draw our attention to in 1 Samuel 15. I'll just read it. Samuel said to Saul, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. And he didn't say, the Lord has torn the kingdom away from you and is giving it to your son. That's not what the Lord said. He said he's given it to one of your neighbors. And just who that neighbor was, this king-to-be, was unknown to them at the time, but it would soon become apparent. God sent Samuel to Bethlehem, you'll recall, to the house of Jesse. God had already chosen one of Jesse's sons to be king, to reign in the place of Saul. And so Jesse puts all seven of his sons, now he had eight, of course, but he put the seven important ones out there, the older ones, and one by one, God told Samuel, no, not him, not him, not him. And finally, he says, are there any others? Well, yeah, the youngest, but he's out in the field. And that was the chosen one. Come to think of it, there's a later mention in the Bible of a field near Bethlehem, in which shepherds watched their sheep by night. And I'm not so sure it wasn't the exact same field, no telling, but it could have been. That night, angels appeared in the sky over this field to announce to lowly shepherds the birth of an unlikely king, one who had descended from another unlikely king, the shepherd boy David, son of Jesse. So Jesse's youngest son was brought in from the field. He appeared before Samuel, and God said, that's the one. 1 Samuel 16, then the Lord said to Samuel, rise and anoint him. He is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Now all this while, everybody in Israel was looking to Jonathan and saying, this is the future king, including Jonathan himself, presumably. The text says David was anointed and the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. It reminds us of Jesus when he went to Nazareth, right? And he went in and on the Sabbath and he read from the scroll of Isaiah and he applied this prophecy to himself. The Spirit of the Lord is on me and has anointed me. You see the similarities. David was a type of Christ. And if you're not familiar with Old Testament typology, I assume you probably are. But David prefigured Christ. That's what that means. His kingdom was pointing ahead to another kingdom, Jesus' kingdom. A greater anointing, a greater king, the Messiah. This is important, and we need to keep this in mind. David, as the anointed king, is a representation of Christ. In chapters 18 to 20, the story now largely centers on an unlikely relationship. And it is from that relationship that I want to draw some applications for us this morning. And the relationship to which I refer is that between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. If you ask people, well, what is there for a Christian to learn when he looks at the relationship between David and Jonathan, what do we get from that? I think what you're going to hear most of the time is that, well, this is really a model relationship. This is a Christian can look at that and pattern his own friendships after the relationship of David and Jonathan. Maybe, I guess, I suppose. But to stop there is to miss the real lesson in the story. The relationship between David and Jonathan is not a model for friendship as I see it, so much as it is a model for something else. Let's look at it. Turn to chapter 18, verse 3, please. And we're going to skip around a little bit, but I want to first read about this covenant that Jonathan made with David, and this was right after David returned from killing Goliath, and everybody was celebrating, even Saul. And it says, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. And I'll comment more on this later. But here's the royal situation right now, so far in 1 Samuel. At this point, Saul is on the throne, but he is losing his grip on the kingdom. God's favor has left him. And by this time, as author Tim Chester notes, Saul is becoming a mere parody of his former self. The more he clings to his power, the more he tries to hold on, the more pitiful he becomes. And if you remember, at one point he went to Naoth, he's going to kill David, and he ends up naked for a whole day. This desperate and futile hope of holding on to power is literally driving him insane as he feels it slipping away. In contrast to David, who everything he puts his hand to is a success, Saul's efforts were one embarrassing failure after another. Now back to Jonathan, and before we talk about his relationship with David, I first want to talk about him. He was Saul's firstborn son. What do we call the firstborn son of a king? Okay, king to be, but he's a prince, right? Jonathan is a prince in Israel. And he's something else that I think we should realize. There's something about him that I think we miss. We often think of David and Jonathan as two friends, right? Essentially equal in age, maybe in their late teens or early 20s, right? If you look at the artwork, you'll see a lot of times you can't even tell who's supposed to be Saul and who's supposed to be Jonathan. They just like look like buddies, high school buddies maybe. Is that what you've always assumed? The Bible tells us that David was 30 years old when he became king, 2 Samuel 5. He was anointed years earlier, but he didn't officially take the throne until he was 30, after Saul's death. Because Saul reigned 40 years, then we know that David was born in the 10th year of Saul's reign, right? 7 years before David was born, 3 years into Saul's reign, Jonathan was leading 1,000 men in Saul's army. And according to Numbers, he had to be 20 years old even to serve in the army. And so it was possible that as a commander of 1,000 men, that Jonathan was actually older than 20. Now, somebody might say, well, maybe he was younger too. Maybe he got special privilege as a prince and got to go into the army a little younger. I suppose that's possible, but at the same time, maybe that's the last person you would want to put in before they're ready. But in any case, these two were not buddies in their late teens or early 20s. It was more like a father-son relationship in terms of the age difference. It's likely that David was around 20 and Saul probably, you know, mid-40s, somewhere in there, late 40s, likely. Here's why that matters. In those days, we can think of several examples, can't we, of you know, would-be kings killing off all potential rivals to the throne, including family members. Jonathan, when David arrived on the scene, Jonathan was already a powerful military leader in Israel, not just a prince. You can read about his bravery and his exploits in chapter 14. He was famous in Israel as a battle-hardened warrior who served his time and in everybody's mind was next in line for the throne. And as a prince, he had probably been reminded for 40 years that this will all be yours someday. I imagine there was somebody, probably an aunt or someone in his life, who was dressing him up as a king and putting a little crown on his head and giving him a little scepter. Here's a guy, his whole life, he'd been reminded that you're next. The kingdom is yours. Of all people on earth, he would have been the least likely candidate to intervene and save David's life as he did on several occasions. And in so doing, he utterly mystified his father Saul, who was obsessed with power, couldn't relate to Jonathan not sharing the same aspirations. Consider the exchange that took place at the New Moon Festival when Saul learned that Jonathan was actually protecting David from him. Chapter 20, verse 30, if you want to go there. This little exchange, it says, this was after he learned that Jonathan was complicit in saving David. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." And of course, for Saul, in his mind, it really wasn't so much about, this is for you, Jonathan. I think it was Saul thinking, this is my dynasty. This is my name and my reputation and my fame. Jonathan's actions showed him to be a man of remarkable spiritual character. And I wonder sometimes if when we're looking at our Bible heroes, if maybe we skip over Jonathan and don't give him quite the credit he deserves. Now, somebody could say, well, we can explain Jonathan's actions because he was really naive to what was going on. He didn't know that David had a future claim on the throne. But if we jump back to verse 12, we see that he knew exactly what he was doing here. He was fully aware of David's destiny. As they were devising their scheme to figure out if Saul wanted to kill David, it says, Jonathan said to David, "By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he's favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. If I do not let you know and send you away safely, may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as you live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." Jonathan knew very well what was going on here. When he says, "May the Lord be with you as he's been with my father," this was a way of saying, "May God establish your kingdom." He's saying the dynasty's over. It's a one-man dynasty. I'm not taking the throne. Jonathan's loyalty to David wasn't because he was naive to what was going on. It was precisely the opposite. he was profoundly aware that David was king-elect, so to speak. He later declared to David at Horesh, chapter 23, verse 17, he says, "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you." Jonathan recognized the Lord's anointed, and it made a difference. That recognition affected him. He gladly accepted God's will and the fact that he was not destined to sit on that throne. And so there was no playing make-believe for Jonathan. Now let's talk about us. We could look at Jonathan's life and David's life and their relationship and say, what a model for our friendships. But I think that would miss it. If David is a type of Christ who prefigures Christ and points forward to him, then who is Jonathan? Does he not represent to us what a faithful disciple should be? So here's the question for me. Am I a modern version of Saul? Am I vainly holding on to the very thing that God is taking away from me? Or am I like Jonathan, knowing my true place and refusing to grab on to what isn't rightfully mine? I want to take three things in Jonathan, things that I think we should want to see in ourselves more and more. And not just this morning as we agree and nod, but really things that affect us every day. Three things that we can learn from Jonathan. Having recognized David as God's anointed, first and maybe most important, Jonathan realized that he was not in charge. David is king. And if that's so, Jonathan is not calling the shots, is he? He says, "You will be king over Israel. I will be second to you. You're the boss. David, you're in charge, not me." And is that the attitude that we display toward our king, toward King Jesus? Jesus was very direct in his claim to kingly authority. The great commission that he gave to his disciples requires that new disciples be made and be taught to obey him. He describes himself as sitting on a kingly throne of authority. He says, "If you love me, you will obey me," John 14, right? He is a king, and he has the right to tell us what to do and how to live. And you know what helps me when I think about that? The fact that I have a king who has my best interests in mind. It's not just that he's in charge. It's that everything that I am to do in following Jesus, obeying his teachings, everything that I am to do is right and good for me. I liked that reflection on God's wisdom this morning. I'm not getting unwise or unloving counsel or commands from my king. If the demons obey Jesus and the winds and the waves obey him, how much more his disciples who gladly acknowledge his authority? And this is a hard thing for us. We want to be in charge of our own lives, don't we? Jonathan said, "I'll be second." That's hard. I'll confess it. It's hard for me, because every day I wake up and I want to be the one in charge. I want to be the one calling the shots. I want to make excuses for my disobedience. And this should be our prayer. Father, don't let me play make-believe. Don't let me, in my pride, be so foolish. Mostly I think it's our sinful nature that's causing us to grasp that authority, try to bring it into ourselves. We're naturally rebels, all of us. But I also think that maybe, as in the case of Jonathan, it's cultural. I think that everything in our culture is saying, you're autonomous, right? You decide. You make your own way. Do you ever see an automobile commercial that says, "Look, we don't want you to buy our car if you feel that you need to give more money to the kingdom. Please don't do that." Everything in our culture is, it's you. You decide. You're in charge of your own life. You're autonomous, right? I think it's cultural. There's no king but me. I'm not second, I'm first. So what do I need to do? I really need to wake up every day And I need to figure out if I'm going to indulge in this fantasy or if, like Jonathan, I'm going to embrace my true position. I'm not king over this domain. It's not my place. And that's a decision I have to make every time that I'm tempted to cheat somebody or fudge the truth a little bit or lust or harbor hatred in my heart or boast, which brings me to the second thing that I want to observe about Jonathan. He seemed to realize that he was not the one deserving of attention. The glory belongs to the true king. Remember what Jonathan did when he made that covenant that we looked at. Remember what he did as he backed that up in chapter 18. It says he made a covenant with David. He took off the robe he was wearing, gave it to David, along with his tunic, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now that's something I think we could read past real quickly and miss the significance of that. And Jonathan's robe, his tunic, his sword, and his bow were not common items, okay? Now, I'm sure, yes, everybody was wearing a robe and a tunic, but these were different. These were the royal belongings of a prince, a future king. Kings didn't want people to look at their own sons as just common people, okay? You've got to know that you don't mess with this guy because he's coming after me. So everywhere Jonathan went, there would be visible reminders of who the coming king would be. These things were recognized. In fact, the sword at one time would have been one of only two swords in all of Israel. Remember that? The Philistines had banned blacksmiths, no blacksmiths allowed in Israel because they didn't want any kind of an uprising. So that was a special sword. That was a royal sword that he carried until he met the real king to be, at which point, becoming aware of that, he realized he had no right to carry that sword anymore. It was a complete and a joyful surrender of the kingdom and the glory. Jonathan knew his role. Jonathan knew that he was really just there to help and to prepare for this transition. And I think it's hard to read that without being reminded of John the Baptist. You remember that story? John the Baptist, one of my favorite stories in the New Testament. I'm not even sure why, but I really like this story. There was this argument that broke out between John's disciples and I think maybe a teacher of the law, and for some reason they came to John, and I'm assuming this had something to do with the argument, but they warned John the Baptist. They said, you know the one that you were talking about, you were telling everybody about, that guy is actually baptizing more people than you. Everybody's going to him. And John panicked and said, no, I need the glory. Get him back here, right? No, that's not what he said. He said this, a man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I'm not the Christ, but I'm sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine and it is now complete. He must become greater. I must become less. I think that is a summary of Christian discipleship. That is our life. He must become greater. I must become less. I thought it was interesting this morning. We sang several songs that had that theme in them of Jesus as king. Behold our God, seated on the, what? Throne. Come, let us adore him. Not me. He must become greater. I must become less. I need to know my place. John the Baptist knew his place. I have no business being the center of attention. It's not my place. I'm only here to point to him. Glory be to God and not to me. And this is something, again, I got to get this into my head every day when I wake up. Every day when I wake up, I got to get this into my head so that it affects my decisions. It's not about my personal glory. And I think, I don't know if you've noticed this, I think our culture, man, it's just more and more and more. Everything is about catering to me. So that everybody can see me. Everything's got to be custom me. Have you noticed that? From social media to products, right? You go out and take a million selfies and put them on Facebook. Why? So that people can see me.
I want them to see this thing that I got, or this thing that I made, or this new look that I have. I want the attention, right? I think the thing that's fueling the whole gender identity thing is me, me, me. This desire, it used to just be for celebrities. Now we have Facebook and YouTube and everything else. We can all do that. And we have to be careful. We have to be careful because for me, like I can look at the guy, I've never wanted tattoos, all right? And I can look at the guy that's got all the tattoos and up the neck and everything, and I can say, this guy wants everybody looking at him. He wants the glory, okay? But what about me? Do I want the glory? Do I say things? Do I make comments that try to elicit a question that will allow me to give a rehearsed answer that I can boast? I know I've done that. Have you done it? Oh, we were at the state fair this weekend. Oh, really? What were you doing there? Well, my daughter got grand champion at the county fair, you know, had to go down there. Surprising, you would ask. Do we make those kind of statements? Do we ask the kind of questions that we hope will be reciprocated so that we can give an answer that puffs us up? Do we do that? Well, where did you go to college? I went here in town, ITT. Oh, okay. Where'd you go to college? Well, I got my undergrad at Princeton. I did my master's work at Harvard. Do we do that kind of thing? I hope nobody here has an Ivy League degree. I'm not picking on you. Just sometimes it's very subtle. It's easy. Honestly, it's easy to look at someone else and see it. Do we see it in ourselves? I know I used to look at, like, I've never really wanted a pimped out Mitsubishi or whatever. You know, I've never wanted that. But I'll be honest, I've looked at the big truck, the four-wheel drive, and the one with the camo lining on the fenders and the camo steering wheel and the camouflage seats and everything. And I think, well, that's cool. I would like that. Why do I want that? Because I want people to know that's me. I want you to know that about me. So we've got our custom man caves, and we've got our custom this, and it's all about me. It's all about getting the attention on me. And I'm telling you, we don't see that in Jonathan. It's like this royal stuff. I shouldn't have it. Get it away from me. David, take it. It's yours. It belongs with you. You see? And the life of a disciple of Christ really needs to be that. And we really need to be open to saying to God, God, where am I trying to steal your glory and your attention? Maybe it's when I get up here, maybe. I don't know. What would it be for you? I think you need to think about that. I think we all do. I'm not trying to pick on anybody. I just think it's a human trait, and I'm thankful for that example of Jonathan, who, man, he was the king to be, and he just, you take it, Jesus. He wanted the glory to go to Jesus, to the king, the true king. So the king is in charge, the king gets the glory, and finally the king is in control. When Jonathan understood that David was king, he threw himself at his mercy, realizing that David was going to decide his fate. It says, but show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Realizing who David is, Jonathan anticipates that David is going to be in a position to protect him. He has faith that God is going to eliminate all of David's enemies, including his own father. And I think you and I live in increasingly uncertain times, don't we? If you tell me, look, I never fret about the future, all this political stuff, I think things are going great. I'm not thinking, I'm not worried about 5 years from now. I'm not thinking about 10 years from now or for my grandkids and my kids. I would say you either have one up on me or you're lying. And you're probably lying. On certain times, we need to remember that we have a defender, we have a protector, we have a king. It's okay if we can't defend ourselves against the tragedies and the uncertainties of life. It's okay that we're not in control. It's okay that we're not self-sufficient, because we serve a king who is all of those things. And I confess that I am very slow to learn that. I am one that I want to preserve myself, and I want to think that I'm in control. I'm not in control. What kind of king is this anyway? Don't we sing "Amazing Love"? How can it be that you, my king, would die for me? Our king did something that David did not do. Our king took the thorns, took the beatings, took the mockings that were mine. Jonathan doesn't give us a model of friendship so much as he gives us a model of discipleship. And if it was fitting for Jonathan to relinquish all claims of royalty, how much more fitting is it that we should follow that example in our own lives, submitting to our king, trusting him, and pointing him to others? And if it was vain and evil and futile and foolish for Saul to cling to what had been taken from him, how much more so would it be wrong for us to resist what the Holy Spirit is doing in us, teaching us to die to ourselves and to live for our King. To him be the kingdom and the glory forever.